branches hanging on cliff edges. Below, the olive orchard's leaves turned to a shimmering silver as zephyrs played through them. Mark watched Kitty standing silhouetted against the sky as a cloud passed behind her. How very lovely she is, Mark thought. Kitty Fremont was the one woman in his world who was different. He had no desire to make love to her. Mark Parker honored little in the world. He wanted to honor Kitty. Moreover, she was the only woman he was absolutely comfortable with. For between them there was no pretense, no impression to make, no games to play. They sat down on a huge boulder and continued to stare at the splendor all about them. The castle, the sea, the sky, the mountains. I think, Mark said at last, this is the most beautiful vista in the world. She nodded. They had been wonderful days for both of them. Kitty seemed renewed since Mark's arrival. She had enjoyed the wonderful therapy of confession. I am thinking something terrible, Kitty said. I am thinking of how glad I am that Colonel Howard Hillings was sent off to Palestine, and I have you all to myself. How long can you stay, Mark?
A few weeks, as long as you want me.
I never want us to become far away from each other again.
You know, he said, everyone at the dome is certain we're shacked up.
Good, Kitty said. I'll put a sign on my door tonight in big red letters to read, I love Mark Parker madly.
They sat for another hour, then reluctantly began working their way down from the summit to descend before it turned dark. After Mark and Kitty had returned to the hotel, Mondria drove his car into Kyrenia to the harbor and stopped on the quay. He stepped outside with Ari and they walked to the docks. Ari looked across the harbor to the tower of the Virgin Castle, which stood on the sea's edge. They crossed over and climbed up inside the tower, and from this vantage point could see the entire area perfectly. Ari studied in his usual silence. The harbor had two sea walls. One ran out from the Virgin Castle and the tower where he now stood. Opposite him were the houses on the quay, and from that side the wall ran out to the sea so that the right and left arms of the seawall formed a new circle, almost touching each other. There was a small break, which was the entrance to the harbor. The inside of the harbor was tiny, not more than a few hundred yards in diameter. It was filled with small boats.
Do you think we can get the Aphrodite inside the harbor here?
Ari asked.
Getting it in won't be a problem, Mondria answered. But turning it around and getting it out again will be.
Ari was silent in thought as the two men walked back toward the car. His eye was on the little harbor. It was beginning to turn dark as they reached the car.
You might as well drive on back to Famagusta by yourself. I have to see someone at the Dome Hotel, Ari said, and I don't know how long it's going to take. I'll find my own way back to Famagusta.
Mondria would have resented being dismissed like a taxi driver, but he was getting used to taking orders from Ben Canaan. He turned the ignition key and pressed the starter.
Mondria, you've been a big help.
Thanks. Mondria beamed as Ari walked away. These were the first words of kindness he had heard from Ben Canaan. He was surprised and touched. The dining room of the Dome Hotel was filled with the strains of a Strauss waltz, playing softly over the drone of British voices, the clink of glasses, and the whisper of the sea outside. Mark sipped his coffee, wiped his lips with his napkin, and then stared over Kitty's shoulder intently at the figure who had entered the doorway. A tall man was whispering into the ear of the head waiter, and the waiter pointed to Mark's table. Mark's eyes widened as he recognized Ari Ben Canaan.
Mark, you look as though you've seen a ghost, Kitty said.
I have, and he's just about here. We are going to have a very interesting evening.
Kitty turned around to see Ari Ben Canaan towering over their table.
I see that you remember me, Parker, he said, taking a seat without invitation and turning to Kitty. You must be Mrs. Catherine Fremont.
Ari's and Kitty's eyes met and held. Several awkward seconds of silence followed. Then Ari looked around for a waiter and called him over. He ordered sandwiches.
This is Ari Ben Kanan, Mark was saying. He is a very old acquaintance of mine. I see that you seem to know Mrs. Fremont.
Ari Ben Kanan, Kitty said. What an odd name.
It is Hebrew, Mrs. Fremont. It means lion, son of Canaan.
That's quite confusing.
On the contrary, Hebrew is a very logical language.
Funny, it didn't strike me that way, Kitty said, with an edge of sarcasm.
Mark looked from one to the other. They had only met, and yet they were already engaged in the verbal fencing and maneuvering he himself so often played. Obviously, Ben Kanan had struck either a sweet or a sour chord in Kitty, Mark thought, because she had her claws bared.
Strange that it wouldn't strike you as logical, Ari was answering. God thought Hebrew was so logical, he had the Bible written in that language.
Kitty smiled and nodded. The orchestra changed to a foxtrot.
Dance, Mrs. Fremont?
Mark leaned back and watched Ben Kanan walk Kitty onto the floor, hold her, and lead her about with smooth, gliding grace. For the moment, Mark didn't like the spark that had obviously struck the second they met. It was hard to think of Kitty as a mere mortal playing mortals' games. They danced close to his table. There seemed to be a dazed look on Kitty's face, and it was unnatural. Then Mark began thinking of himself. He had had the feeling that something was brewing on Cyprus from the moment he landed. Now it was confirmed by Ben Kanan's appearance. He knew enough of the Palestinian to realize he was one of the top Mossad Aliyah Bet agents. He also knew that he was going to be approached for something, because Ben Kanan had sought him out. What about Kitty? Did he know of her only because she was with him, or was there another reason? Kitty was a tall girl, but she felt lost in Ari Ben Kanan's arms. A strange sensation swept over her. The appearance of this strapping, handsome man had thrown her off guard. Now, in his arms only a moment after their meeting, she felt unraveled. The sensation was attractive. It had been many, many years, but she felt rather foolish at the same time. The music stopped and they returned to the table.
I didn't think you Palestinians danced anything but a hora, Mark said. I've been exposed to too much of your culture, Ari answered.
His sandwiches arrived, and he ate hungrily. Mark waited patiently for him to reveal the nature of his visit. He looked at Kitty carefully. She seemed to be regaining her composure, although she glanced at Ari from the corner of her eye as though she were wary and ready to strike. At last Ari finished eating and said casually,
I have something I want to talk over with both of you.
Here, in the middle of the British Army? Ari smiled. He turned to Kitty.
Parker didn't have a chance to tell you, Mrs. Fremont, that my employment is considered sub rosa in some quarters. Every so often the British even glorify us by calling us underground. One of the first things I try to impress a new member of our organization with is the danger of making secret midnight rendezvous. I'd say there isn't a better place in the world to discuss this.
Let's move the party up to my room, Mark said. As soon as they had closed the door behind them, Ari got right to the point.
Parker, you and I are in a position to do each other a good turn.
Go on.
Are you familiar with the detention camps at Karaolos?
Both Mark and Kitty nodded.
I have just completed plans for 300 children to make an escape. We're going to bring them over here and load them aboard a ship in the Kyrenia harbor.
You boys have been smuggling refugees into Palestine for years. That isn't news anymore, Ben Kanan.
It will be news if you help make it news. You remember the commotion over our illegal ship, the Promised Land?
Sure.
The British looked pretty bad then. We feel that if we can create another incident as important as the Promised Land, we stand a chance of breaking their immigration policy on Palestine.
You just lost me, Mark said. If you can pull a mass escape from Karaolos, how are you going to get them to Palestine? If they do escape, then where is the story?
That's the point, Ari said. They aren't going any farther than boarding ship in Kyrenia. I have no intention of making a run for Palestine.
Mark leaned forward. He was interested, and there was obviously more to Ben Canaan's plan than first appeared.
Let's say, Ari said, that I get 300 orphans out of Karaolos and on a ship in Kyrenia. Let's say the British find out and stop the ship from sailing. Now, let's say you have already written a story and it is sitting in Paris or New York. The minute those children board ship, your story hits the headlines.
Mark whistled under his breath. Like most American correspondents, he had sympathy for the refugees' plight. Mark would get the story, Ben Canaan would get the propaganda value. Was the story going to be big enough for him to become involved? There was no way he could seek instructions or talk it over. He alone had to evaluate and make the decision. Ari had thrown him just enough to whet his appetite. To question the Palestinian further could open the door to involvement. Mark looked at Kitty. She seemed completely puzzled by the whole thing.
How are you going to get 300 children from Karaolis to Kyrenia? Do I take that to understand you are coming in?
Take it to understand I want to know. It doesn't commit me to a thing. If I decide against it, you have my word that anything said will not leave this room.
Good enough, Ari said.
He balanced himself on the edge of the dresser and explained his escape plan step by step. Mark frowned. It was daring, audacious, even fantastic. Yet, there was an admirable simplicity about it. For his part, Mark had to write a report and smuggle it out of Cyprus to the ANS Paris or London Bureau. By some prearranged signal, the report would be published at the exact moment the escape was taking place. Ari finished, and Mark digested the plan for many moments. He lit a cigarette, paced the room, and fired a dozen questions at Ari. Ari seemed to have considered all the angles. Yes, there was a possibility of a sensational series of stories. Now Mark tried to weigh the odds of Ari's wild scheme. There was no better than a 50-50 chance of success. Mark took into account the fact that Ari was an extremely clever man, and he knew the British thinking on Cyprus. He also knew that Ari had the kind of people working with him who would be most likely to pull such a thing off.
Count me in, Mark said.
Good,
Ari said. I thought you'd see the possibilities.
He turned to Kitty. Mrs. Fremont, about a week ago you were offered a job working in the children's compound. Have you considered it?
I decided not to take it.
Would you reconsider it now, say, to help Parker?
Just what do you have in mind for Kitty? Mark asked.
All of the teachers, nurses, and welfare people coming in from the outside are Jews, Ari said, and we must go under the assumption they are suspect by the British.
Suspect of what?
Cooperation with the Mossad. You are a Christian, Mrs. Fremont. We feel that someone of your background and religion could move about more freely.
In other words, you want to use Kitty as a courier.
More or less. We manufacture quite a few papers inside the camp that are needed outside.
Mark said, I think I'd better tell you that I'm not too popular with the British. Sutherland's aide was sitting on my lap the minute I landed. I don't think this will affect me, but if Kitty goes to work at Karaolos, it would be a cinch they'd suspect her of working with me.
On the contrary, they would be dead certain you would not send her to work at Karaolos.
Maybe you're right.
Of course I'm right, Ari said. Let us assume that the worst happens. Let us say Mrs. Fremont gets caught with forged papers. Absolutely nothing will happen to her except some embarrassment, an escort, and a free ticket away from Cyprus.
Just a moment, Kitty said. I've listened to you two divide me up. I'm very sorry that I had to hear any of what went on here tonight. I am not going to work at Karaolos, Mr. Ben Canaan, and I'm not getting mixed up in this scheme of yours.
Ari looked quickly to Mark, who merely shrugged.
She's a big girl.
I thought you were a friend of Parker's.
I am, Kitty said, and I understand his interest.
I don't understand your lack of it, Mrs. Fremont. This is the end of 1946. In a few months, the war in Europe will have been over for 2 years. We have people behind barbed wire under the most terrible conditions. There are children in Garaolos who have no idea there is a world outside barbed wire. If we don't break this British policy, they can well be behind barbed wire the rest of their lives.
That is just the point, Kitty fired back. Everything connected with Garaolos is neck-deep in politics. I am certain that the British have their reasons. I don't wish to take sides.
Mrs. Fremont, I was a captain in the British Army, and I hold a military cross for valor. To coin an old cliché, some of my best friends are British. The fact is that we have dozens of British officers and soldiers who can't stomach what is happening in Palestine and who work with us 24 hours a day. This is not a case of politics, but of humanity.
I doubt your sincerity. Why would you risk the lives of 300 children?
Most human beings have a purpose for living, Ari said. There is no purpose in Garaolos. Fighting for your freedom is a purpose. We have a 250,000 people in Europe who want to get into Palestine. Any one of them would board that ship in Kyrenia if given the choice.
You are a very clever man, Mr. Ben-Kanan. I cannot argue with you. I don't have your stock list of answers.
I thought you were a nurse, he said sarcastically.
The world is filled with suffering. I can give my services 1,000 places just as needful as Garaolos without the strings attached.
Why don't you visit Garaolos and tell me that afterwards?
You're not going to trick me, and you're not going to issue me challenges. I worked the night shift at a Cook County hospital, and more nights than not I've blotted up bodies off the receiving room floor. You can't show me anything at Garaolos that I haven't seen before.
The room became quiet. Ari Ben-Kanan blew a long breath and threw up his hands in defeat.
I am sorry, he said. I'll be in touch with you in a few days, Parker.
He turned for the door.
Mr. Ben-Kanan, Kitty said, are you quite certain that I won't go telling this story to our mutual friends?
Ari walked back and looked down into her eyes. She knew that instant she had said the wrong thing. A cruel little smile crossed his face.
I think you are just trying to be a woman and have the last word. I don't misjudge people very often. I can't afford to. I like Americans. Americans have consciences. As soon as yours begins to get the best of you, you can reach me at Mr. Mandria's, and I'll be glad to show you around Garaolos.
You are quite sure of yourself, aren't you?
Let us say, Ari answered, that right this minute I am surer of myself than you are.
Ari walked from the room. It took a long time after Ari left for the impact of his visit to subside. Kitty kicked off her shoes at last and sat back on the bed.
Well, you did say we were in for an interesting evening.
I think you made a wise choice by staying out of this thing.
And you?
It's a day's work. It could turn into something very big.
Suppose you had refused him.
Oh, they'd get another correspondent somewhere in Europe to come over to Cyprus. They are very resourceful people. I just happened to be conveniently here.
Mark, Kitty said thoughtfully, did I make a fool of myself?
I don't suppose you made yourself any more foolish than 100 other women have. Mark said it deliberately to let Kitty know she had been obvious about her attraction to Ari.
He is a gorgeous man. When did you meet him?
The first time was in Berlin in the early part of 1939. That was my first ANS post. He had been sent over by Mossad Aliyah Bet to get as many Jews out of Germany as he could before the war started. He was in his early 20s then. I saw him again in Palestine. He was in the British Army. This was during the war. It was some kind of undercover assignment. I don't know exactly what it was. Since the war, he's been heard of showing up all over Europe, buying arms, smuggling refugees into Palestine.
Do you really think he can get away with this utterly fantastic plan of his?
He's a clever man.
Well, I'll say one thing. This Ben-Kanan doesn't act like any Jew I've ever met. You know what I mean. You don't particularly think of them in a capacity like his, or fighters, things of that sort.
How do you think of them, Kitty? The good old Indiana version? The little Jew boy named Maury, who's going to marry a little Jew girl named Sadie?
Oh, stop it, Mark. I've worked with enough Jewish doctors to know they are arrogant and aggressive people. They look down on us.
With what? An inferiority complex?
I'd buy that if you were talking about Germany.
What are you trying to say, Kitty? That we're pure?
I'm saying no American Jew would trade places with a Negro or a Mexican or an Indian, for that matter.
And I'm saying you don't have to lynch a man to rip his insides out. Oh, sure, the American Jews have it good, but just enough of your thinking and enough of 2,000 years of being a scapegoat has rubbed off on them. Why don't you argue it with Ben Kanan? He seems to know how to handle you. Kitty shot off the bed angrily. Then both she and Mark began to laugh. They were Mark and Kitty, and they could not really be angry.
Exactly what is this Mossad Aliyah bet?
The word Aliyah means to arise, go up, ascend. When a Jew goes to Palestine, it is always referred to as an Aliyah, always going higher than he was. Aleph, or the letter A, was used to designate the legal immigration. Bet, or the letter B, for the illegal. Therefore, Mossad Aliyah Bet means Organization for Illegal Immigration.
Kitty smiled. My goodness, she said. Hebrew is such a logical language.
For the next 2 days after Ari Ben-Kanan's visit, Kitty was perturbed and restless. She would not admit to herself that she wanted to see the big Palestinian again. Mark knew Kitty well and sensed her irritation, but he pretended to carry on as though Ben-Kanan had never entered the scene. She did not exactly know what was disturbing her, except that Ben-Kanan's visit had left a strong impression. Was it that American conscience that Ben-Kanan knew so well? Or was she sorry about her anti-Jewish outburst? Almost, but not quite casually, Kitty inquired when Mark expected to see Ari. Another time she made an unsubtle suggestion that it would be nice to go sightseeing in Famagusta. Then again she would grow angry with herself and resolve to wipe out any thought of Ari. On the third night, Mark could hear Kitty's footsteps through the connecting door as she paced back and forth in her room. She sat in the darkness, in an overstuffed chair, and puffed on a cigarette, and decided that she would reason out the whole matter. She did not like being drawn against her will into Ben Kanan's strange world. Her entire approach to life had been sane, even calculating. Kitty is such a sensible girl, they always said of her. When she fell in love with Tom Fremont and set out to win him, it had all been a well-thought-out move. She ran a sensible home and served sensible meals on a sensible budget. She planned to give birth to Sandra in the springtime, and that had been sensible too. She stifled spur-of-the-moment impulses in favor of planned decisions. These past 2 days seemed to make no sense to her at all. A strange man appeared from nowhere and told her an even stranger story. She saw that hard, handsome face of Ari Ben-Kanan with his penetrating eyes that seemed to read her mind mockingly. She remembered the sensation in his arms, dancing with him. There was no logic to this at all. For one thing, Kitty always felt uncomfortable around Jewish people. She had admitted as much to Mark. Then why did this thing continue to grow? Finally, she knew that she would continue to be disturbed until she saw Ari again and saw the camp at Karaolos. She decided that the way to beat this whole idea was to see him again and assure herself she was not mystically involved but had merely been jolted by a sudden and brief infatuation. She would beat Ari Ben-Kanan at his own game, on his own ground. At breakfast the next morning, Mark was not surprised when Kitty asked him to make an appointment with Ben-Kanan for her to visit Karaolos. Honey, I was happy with the decision you made the other night. I wish you'd stick to it.
I don't quite understand this myself, she said.
Ben-Kanan called the shot. He knew you'd come around. Don't be a damned fool. If you go to Karaolos, you're in. Look, I'll pull out myself,
We'll leave Cyprus right away.
Kitty shook her head. You're letting your curiosity throw you. You've always been smart. What's happening?
This sounds funny coming from me, doesn't it, Mark? But it almost feels as if some force were pushing me. Believe me, I'm going to Karaolos to end all this, and not to start something.
Mark told himself that she was hooked, even though she was pretending she wasn't. He hoped that whatever lay ahead would treat her kindly.
Chapter 10 Kitty handed her passes to the British sentry at the gate and entered Karaolos at Compound 57, which was closest to the children's compound.
Are you Mrs. Fremont?
She turned, nodded, and looked into the face of a young man who smiled and offered his hand. She thought that he was certainly a much friendlier appearing person than his compatriot.
I am David Ben-Ami, he said. Ari asked me to meet you. You will be along in a few moments. Now, what does Ben-Ami mean? I've taken a recent interest in Hebrew names. It means son of my people, he answered. We hope that you will help us in Operation Gideon.
Operation Gideon?
Yes, that's what I call Ari's plan. Do you remember your Bible? Judges? Gideon had to select a group of soldiers to go against the Midianites. He picked 300. We have also picked 300 to go against the British. I guess I may be stretching a point for the parallel, and Ari does accuse me of being too sentimental.
Kitty had braced herself for a difficult evening. Now she was disarmed by this mild-appearing young man. The day was closing, and a cool breeze whipped up a swirl of dust. Kitty slipped into her topcoat. On the other side of the compound, she could make out the unmistakable towering figure of Ari Ben-Kanan crossing over to meet her. She drew a deep breath and steadied herself to fight off the same electric sensation she had felt the first time she saw him. He stopped before her, and they nodded silently. Kitty's eyes were cold. She was letting him know, without a word, that she had come to accept a challenge and she had no intention of losing. Compound 57 consisted mostly of the aged and very religious. They passed slowly between two rows of tents filled with dirty and unkempt people. The water shortage, Ben-Ami explained, made bathing virtually impossible. There was also insufficient diet. The inmates appeared weak, some angry, some dazed, and all haunted by ghosts of the dead. They stopped for a moment at an opened tent where a wrinkled old specimen worked on a wood carving. He held it up for her to see. It was a pair of hands, clasped in prayer and bound by barbed wire. Ari watched her closely for a sign of weakening. It was squalid, filthy, and wretched here, but Kitty had prepared herself to accept even worse. She was beginning to be convinced that Ari Ben-Kanan held no mysterious power over her. They stopped once more to look into a large tent used as a synagogue. Over the entrance was a crudely made symbol of the menorah, the ritual candelabra. She stared at the strange sight of old men swaying back and forth and reciting weird prayers. To Kitty, it seemed another world. Her gaze became fixed on one particularly dirty, bearded old individual who wept and cried aloud in anguish. She felt David's hand lead her away.
He is just an old man, David said. He is telling God that he has lived a life of faith. He has kept God's laws, cherished the Holy Torah, and kept the covenants in face of unbelievable hardships. He asks God to kindly deliver him for being a good man.
The old men in there, Ari said, don't quite realize that the only Messiah that will deliver them is a bayonet on the end of a rifle.
Kitty looked at Ari. There was something deadly about this man. Ari felt Kitty's disdain. His hands grabbed her arms.
Do you know what a Sonderkommando is?
Ari, please, David said.
A Sonderkommando is one who was forced by the Germans to work inside of their crematoriums. I'd like to show you another old man here. He took the bones of his grandchildren out of a crematorium in Buchenwald and carted them off in a wheelbarrow. Tell me, Mrs. Fremont, Did you see one better than that at the Cook County Hospital?
Kitty felt her stomach turn over. Then resentment took over and she fired back, eyes watering with anger.
You'll stop at nothing.
I'll stop at nothing to show you how desperate we are.
They glared at each other wordlessly.
Do you wish to see the children's compound or not? He said at last.
Let's get it over with,
Kitty answered. The three crossed the bridge over the barbed wire wall into the children's compound and looked upon war's merciless harvest. She went through the hospital building past the long row of tuberculars and into the other wards of bones bent with rickets and skins yellow of jaundice and festering sores of poisoned blood. She went through a locked ward filled with youngsters who had the hollow, blank stares of the insane. They walked along the tents of the graduation class of 1940-45. The matriculants of the ghettos, the concentration camp students, scholars of rubble, motherless, fatherless, homeless, shaved heads of the deloused, ragged clothing, terror-filled faces, bedwetters, night shriekers, howling infants and scowling juveniles who had stayed alive only through cunning. They finished the inspection.
You have an excellent staff of medical people, Kitty said, and this children's compound is getting the best of the supplies.
The British have given us none of it, Ari snapped. It has come as gifts from our own people.
You made the point right there, Kitty said. I don't care if your facilities are manna from heaven. I came at the request of my American conscience. It has been satisfied. I'd like to go. Mrs. Fremont, David Ben-Ami said,
David, don't argue. Some people find just the sight of us repulsive. Show Mrs. Fremont out.
David and Kitty walked along a tent street. She turned slightly and saw Ari staring at her back. She wanted to get out as quickly as possible. She wanted to return to Mark and forget the whole wretched business. A sound of uninhibited laughter burst from a large tent near her. It was the laughter of happy children, and it sounded out of place at Karaolos. Kitty stopped in curiosity before the tent and listened. A girl was reading a story. She had a beautiful voice.
That is an exceptional girl, David said. She does fantastic work with these children.
Again, laughter erupted from the children. Kitty stepped to the tent flap and drew it open. The girl had her back to Kitty. She sat on a wooden box, bent close to a kerosene lamp. Circling her sat 20 wide-eyed children. They looked up as Kitty and David entered. The girl stopped reading and turned around and arose to greet the newcomers. The lamp flickered from a gust of air that swept in from the open flap and cast a dancing shadow of children's silhouettes. Kitty and the girl stood face to face. Kitty's eyes opened wide, registering shock. She walked out of the tent quickly, then stopped and turned and stared through the flap at the astonished girl. Several times she started to speak and lapsed into bewildered silence.
I want to see that girl alone, she finally said in a hushed voice.
Ari had come up to them. He nodded to David.
Bring the child to the school building. We will wait there.
Ari lit the lantern in the schoolroom and closed the door behind them. Kitty had remained wordless, and her face was pale.
That girl reminds you of someone, Ari said abruptly.
She did not answer. He looked through the window and saw the shadows of David and the girl crossing the compound. He glanced at Kitty again and walked from the room. As he left, Kitty shook her head.
It was mad. Why did she come? Why did she come?
She fought to get herself under command, to brace herself to look at that girl again. The door opened and Kitty tensed. The girl stepped slowly into the room. She studied the girl's face, fighting off the urge to clutch the child in her arms. The girl looked at her curiously, but she seemed to understand something, and her gaze conveyed pity.
"My name is Catherine Fremont," Kitty said unevenly. "Do you speak English?"
"Yes."
What a lovely child she was. Her eyes sparkled and she smiled now and held out her hand to Kitty.
Kitty touched the girl's cheek, then she dropped her hand.
I am a nurse. I wanted to meet you. What is your name?"
"My name is Karen," the girl said. "Karen Hansen Clement."
Kitty sat on the cot and asked the girl to sit down, too.
"How old are you?"
"I'm 16 now, Mrs. Fremont. Please, call me Kitty."
"All right, Kitty."
"I hear that you work with the children."
The girl nodded.
"That's wonderful. You see, I may be coming to work here, and I'd like to know all about you. Would you mind telling me?"
Karen smiled. Already she liked Kitty, and she knew instinctively that Kitty wanted, needed, to be liked.
"Originally," Karen said, "I came from Germany, Cologne, Germany. But that was a long time ago."
Chapter 11. Cologne, Germany, 1938. Life is quite wonderful if you are a young lady of 7 and your daddy is the famous Professor Johann Clement, and it is carnival time in Cologne. Many things are extra special around carnival time. But something that is always extra special is taking a walk with Daddy. You can walk under the linden trees along the banks of the Rhine, or you can walk through the zoo that has the most magnificent monkey cages in the entire world, or you can walk past the big cathedral and stare up at those twin towers over 500 feet high that seem to push right through the sky. Best of all is walking through the municipal forest very early in the morning with Daddy and Maximilian. Maximilian is the most remarkable dog in Cologne, even though he looks kind of funny. Of course, Maximilian isn't allowed in the zoo. Sometimes you take Hans along on your walks, too, but little brothers can be a nuisance. If you are such a little girl, you love your mommy, too, and wish she would come along with you and Daddy and Hans and Maximilian, but she is pregnant again and feeling rather grumpy these days. It would be nice if the new baby is a sister, because one brother is just about as much as a girl can bear. On Sunday, everyone, except poor Maximilian, who has to watch the house, gets into the auto, and Daddy drives along the Rhine River to Grandma's house in Bonn. Many of the aunts and uncles and bratty cousins gather every Sunday, and Grandma has baked 100 cookies, or maybe even more. Soon, when summer comes, there will be a wonderful trip along the coast up north and through the Black Forest, or to Brenner's Park Hotel at the Springs at Baden-Baden. What a funny name, Baden-Baden. Professor Johann Clement is a terribly important man. Everyone at the university doffs his cap and smiles and bows and says, "Good morning, Herr Doctor." At night, there are other professors and their wives and sometimes 15 or 20 students pack into Daddy's study. They sing and argue and drink beer all night long. Before Mommy's stomach started showing, she used to like to joke and dance with them. There are so many wonderful tastes and smells and feelings and sounds for a happy 7-year-old girl. The best times of all were those nights when there would be no visitors and Daddy didn't have to work in his study or give a lecture. The whole family would sit before the fireplace. It was wonderful to sit on Daddy's lap and watch the flames and smell his pipe and hear his soft, deep voice as he read a fairy tale. In those years of 1937 and 1938, many strange things were happening you could not quite understand. People seemed frightened of something and spoke in whispers, especially at a place like the university. But these things seem quite unimportant when it comes carnival time. Professor Johann Clement had very much to think about. With so much utter insanity all about, a man had to keep a clear head. Clement reckoned a scientist could actually chart the course of human events as one would chart the tides and waves of the sea. There were waves of emotion and hate and waves of complete unreason. They'd reach a peak and fall to nothingness. All mankind lived in this sea except for a few who perched on islands so high and dry they remained always out of the reach of the mainstream of life. A university, Johann Clement reasoned, was such an island, such a sanctuary. Once, during the Middle Ages, there had been a wave of hatred and ignorance as the Crusaders killed off Jews. But the day had passed when Jews were blamed for the Black Death and for poisoning the wells of Christians. During the Enlightenment that followed the French Revolution, the Christians themselves had torn down the gates of the ghettos. In this new era, the Jews and the greatness of Germany had been inseparable. Jews subordinated their own problems to the greater problems of mankind. They assimilated to the larger society. And what great men came from this! Heine and Rothschild and Karl Marx and Mendelssohn and Freud. The list was endless. These men, like Johann Clement himself, were Germans first, last, and always. Anti-Semitism was synonymous with the history of man, Johann Clement reasoned. It was a part of living, almost a scientific truth. Only the degree and the content varied. Certainly, he felt, he was far better off than the Jews of Eastern Europe or those in semi-barbaric condition in Africa. The humiliation oaths and the Frankfurt massacre belonged to another age. Germany might be riding a new wave, but he was not going to turn around and run. Nor would he stop believing that the German people, with their great cultural heritage, would ultimately dispose of the abnormal elements which had temporarily got control of the country. Johann Clement watched the blows fall. First, there had been wild talk, and then printed accusations and insinuations. Then came a boycott of Jewish business and professional people. Then the public humiliations, beatings and beard pullings. Then came the night terror of the brown shirts. Then came the concentration camps. Gestapo, SS, SD, Kripo, RSHA. Soon every family in Germany was under Nazi scrutiny, and the grip of tyranny tightened until the last croak of defiance strangled and died. Still, Professor Johann Clement, like most of the Jews in Germany, continued to believe he was immune to the new menace. His grandfather had established a tradition at the university. It was Johann Clement's island and his sanctuary. He identified himself completely as a German. There was one particular Sunday that you would never forget. Everyone had assembled at Grandma's house in Bonn. Even Uncle Ingo had come all the way from Berlin. All of the children were sent outside to play, and the door to the living room had been locked. On the way home to Cologne, neither Mommy nor Daddy spoke a single word. Grown-ups act like children sometimes. As soon as you reached home, you and your brother Hans were bundled right off to bed. But more and more of these secret talks had been taking place, and if you stood by the door and opened it just a crack, you could hear everything. Mommy was terribly upset. Daddy was as calm as ever.
Johann, darling, we must think about making a move. This time it is not going to pass us by. It's getting so I'm afraid to go out into the street with the children.
Perhaps it is only your pregnancy that makes you think things are worse.
For 5 years you have been saying it is going to get better. It is not going to get better.
As long as we stay at the university, we are safe.
For God's sake, Johann, stop living in a fool's paradise. We have no friends left. The students never come anymore. Everyone we know is too terrified to speak to us.
Johann Clement lit his pipe and sighed. Miriam cuddled at his feet and lay her head on his lap, and he stroked her hair. Nearby, Maximilian stretched and groaned before the fire.
I want so much to be as brave and as understanding as you are,
Miriam said.
My father and my grandfather taught here. I was born in this house. My life, the only things I've ever wanted, the only things I've ever loved, are in these rooms. My only ambition is that Hans will come to love it so after me. Sometimes I wonder if I have been fair to you and the children, but something inside of me will not let me run. Just a little longer, Miriam. It will pass. It will pass.
November 19th, 1938. 200 synagogues gutted. 200 Jewish apartment houses torn apart. 8,000 Jewish shops looted and smashed. 50 Jews murdered. 3,000 Jews seriously beaten. 20,000 Jews arrested. From this day on, no Jew may belong to a craft or trade. From this day on, no Jewish child may enter a public school. From this day on, no Jewish child may enter a public park or recreation ground. A special fine of $150 million is hereby levied on all the Jews of Germany. From this day on, all Jews must wear a yellow armband with the Star of David. It was hard to believe that things could get worse. But the tide ran higher and higher, and the waves finally crashed onto Johann Clement's island when one day little Karen ran into the house, her face covered with blood, and the words,
"Jew! Jew! Jew!"
ringing in her ears. When a man has roots so deep and faith so strong, the destruction of his faith is an awesome catastrophe. Not only had Johann Clement been a fool, but he had endangered the life of his family as well. He searched for some way out, and his path led to the Gestapo in Berlin. When he returned from Berlin, he locked himself in his study for 2 days and two nights, remaining there, hunched over his desk, staring at the document that lay before him. It was a magic paper the Gestapo had presented him with. His signature on the paper would free him and his family from any further harm. It was a life-giving document. He read it over and over again, until he knew every word on its pages. I, Johann Clement, after the above detailed search and the undeniable facts contained herein, am of the absolute conviction that the facts concerning my birth have been falsified. I am not now, or never have been, of the Jewish religion. I am an Aryan, and...
Sign it. Sign it.
1,000 times he picked up the pen to write his name on the paper. This was no time for noble stands. He had never been a Jew. Why not sign? It made no difference. Why not sign? The Gestapo made it absolutely clear that Johann Clement had but one alternative. If he did not sign the paper and continue his work in research, his family could leave Germany only if he remained as a political hostage. On the third morning, he walked from the study, haggard, and looked into Miriam's anxious eyes. He went to the fireplace and threw the document into the flames.
"I cannot do it," he whispered. "You must plan to leave Germany with the children immediately."
A terrible fear overtook him now, for every moment that his family remained, every knock on the door, every ring of the phone, every footstep brought a new terror he had never known. He made his plans. First, the family would go to live with some colleagues in France. Miriam was nearly due, and she could not travel far. After the baby came and her strength had returned, they would continue on to England or America. It was not all hopeless. Once the family was safe, he could worry about himself. There were a few secret societies working in Germany which specialized in smuggling out German scientists. He had been tipped off to one working in Berlin, a group of Palestinian Jews who called themselves Mossad Aliyah Bet. The trunks were all packed, the house closed down. The man and his wife sat that last night in silence, desperately hoping for some sudden miracle to give them a reprieve. But that night, the day before departure, Miriam Clement began having her labor pains. She was not permitted into a hospital, so she gave birth in her own bedroom. Another son was born. It had been a difficult and complicated delivery, and she needed several weeks to convalesce. Panic seized Johann Clement. He had visions of his family being trapped and never able to escape the approaching Holocaust. He frantically rushed to Berlin, to number 10 Meinecke-Strasse, the building which housed the Mossad Aliyah Bet. The place was a bedlam of people trying desperately to get out of Germany. At 2 o'clock in the morning, he was led into an office where a very young and very exhausted man met him. The man was named Ari Ben Kanan, and he was a Palestinian in charge of the escape of the German Jews. Ben Kanan looked at him through bloodshot eyes. He sighed. "We will arrange your escape, Dr. Clement. Go home, you will be contacted. I have to get a passport, a visa. I have to pay the right people off. It will take a few days." "It is not for me. I cannot go, nor can my wife. I have 3 children. You must get them out." "I must get them out," Ben Kanan mimicked. "Doctor, you are an important man. I may be able to help you. I cannot help your children."
"You must! You must!" he shrieked.
Ari Ben Kanan slammed his fist on his desk and jumped up.
"Did you see that mob out there? They all want to get out of Germany."
He leaned over the desk, an inch from Johann Clement.
"For 5 years we have pleaded, we have begged you to leave Germany. Now, even if you can get out, the British won't let you into Palestine. We are Germans, we are Germans. They won't hurt us, you said. What in God's name can I do?"
Ari swallowed and slumped down into his chair. His eyes closed a moment, his face masked in weariness. He picked up a sheaf of papers from his desk and thumbed through them.
"I have obtained visas for 400 children to leave Germany. Some families in Denmark have agreed to take them. We have a train organized. I will put one of your children on."
I have 3 children.
"And I have 10,000 children. I have no visas. I have nothing to fight the British Navy with. I suggest you send your oldest, who will be better able to take care of itself. The train leaves tomorrow night from Berlin, from the Potsdam station."
Karen clung drowsily to her favorite rag doll. Daddy knelt before her. In her half-sleep, she could smell that wonderful smell of his pipe.
"It is going to be a wonderful trip, Karen. Just like going to Baden-Baden."
"But I don't want to, Daddy."
"Well, now, look at all these nice boys and girls going along with you."
"But I don't want them. I want you and Mommy and Hans and Maximilian. And I want to see my new baby brother."
"See here, Karen Clement. My girl doesn't cry."
"I won't. I promise I won't. Daddy? Daddy, will I see you soon?"
"We'll all try very hard."
A woman stepped behind Johann Clement and tapped him on the shoulder.
"I'm sorry," she said. "It is time for departure."
"I'll take her on."
"No. I am sorry. No parents on the train."
He nodded and hugged Karen quickly and stood back, biting his pipe so hard his teeth hurt. Karen took the woman's hand, then stopped and turned around. She handed her father her rag doll.
"Daddy, you take my dolly. She'll look after you."
Scores of anguished parents pressed close to the sides of the train, and the departing children pressed against the windows, shouting, blowing kisses, waving, straining desperately for a last glimpse. He looked, but could not see her. The steel train grumbled into motion. The parents ran alongside, screaming final farewells. Johann Clement stood motionless on the fringe of the crowd. As the last car passed, he looked up and saw Karen standing calmly on the rear platform. She put her hand to her lips and blew him a kiss, as though she knew she would never see him again. He watched her tiny figure grow smaller and smaller and smaller. And then she was gone. He looked at the little rag doll in his hand.
"Goodbye, my life," he whispered.
Chapter 12. Og and Mette Hansen had a lovely home in the suburbs of Aalborg. It was just right for a little girl, for they had no children of their own. The Hansens were quite a bit older than the Clements. Og was graying, and Mette was nowhere as beautiful as Miriam. But nonetheless, Karen felt warm and protected from the moment they carried her drowsy little body into their car. The train ride into Denmark had been bewildering. All she could remember was the stifled sobs of children all around her. The rest was a blur. Standing in lines, being tagged, strange faces, strange language. Then waiting rooms, buses, more tags. At last, she was led alone into the room where Mette and Og Hansen stood waiting anxiously. Og knelt down and lifted her and carried her to the car, and Mette held her in her lap and fussed and petted her all the way to Aalborg, and Karen knew she was safe. Og and Mette stood back expectantly in the doorway as Karen tiptoed cautiously into the room they had prepared for her. It was filled with dolls and toys and books and dresses and records, and just about everything one little girl could ever want. Then Karen saw the floppy little puppy on her bed. She knelt beside him and stroked him, and he licked her face, and she felt a wet nose against her cheek. She turned and smiled at the Hansens, and they smiled back. Those first few nights without her daddy and mommy were awful. It was surprising how much she missed her brother Hans. She nibbled at her food and just sat alone quietly in her room with the little dog she had named Maximilian. Mette Hansen understood. At night she lay beside Karen and held her and soothed her until her soft little sobs subsided into sleep. During the next week, a steady stream of visitors came with presents and made a great fuss over Karen and babbled in a language she still could not understand. The Hansens were very proud, and she did her best to be nice to everyone. In a few more days, she ventured out of the house. Karen was terribly fond of Og Hansen. He smoked a pipe like her daddy, and he liked to take walks. Aalborg was an interesting place. Like Cologne, it had a river, called the Limfjorden. Mr. Hansen was a lawyer and very important, and almost everyone seemed to know him. Of course, he wasn't as important as her daddy, but few people were. "Well now, Karen, you have been with us for nearly 3 weeks," Og said one night, "and we would like to have a very important talk with you." He clasped his hands behind him and paced back and forth and talked to her in a very wonderful way so that she understood. He told her that there was much unhappiness in Germany, and her mommy and daddy thought it would be better if she remained with them for the time being. Og Hansen went on to say that they knew they could never replace her own parents, but because God had not let them have children of their own, they were very happy to have her and wanted her to be happy too. Yes, Karen understood it all and told Og and Mette she didn't mind staying with them for the time being. "And Karen, darling, because we are borrowing you for a little while, and because we love you so much, we wonder, would you mind borrowing our name?" Karen thought about that. It seemed to her that Og had other reasons. His question had that grown-up sound, like the sound of her mommy and daddy talking behind closed doors. She nodded and said that it would be fine with her, too.
"Good. Karen Hansen it is, then."
They took her hands, as they did every night, and led her to her room and put on the low lamp. Og played with her and tickled her, and Maximilian got mixed up in the fracas. She laughed until she couldn't stand anymore. Then she got under the covers and said her prayers.
"God bless Mommy and Daddy and Hans, and my new baby brother, and all my aunts and uncles and cousins, and God bless the Hansens who are so nice, and God bless both Maximilians. I will be back in a few minutes to sit with you,
Meta said.
That's all right. You don't have to stay with me anymore. Maximilian will take care of me.
Good night, Karin. Yes?
Do the Danish people hate the Jews too?
My dear Dr. and Mrs. Clement, has it already been 6 weeks since Karin came to us? What an exceptional child she is. Her teacher tells us she is doing extremely well in school. It is amazing how quickly she is picking up Danish. I suppose that is because she is with children her own age. She has already gathered a large number of girlfriends. The dentist advised us to have one tooth pulled to make room for another. It was a small matter. We want to start her on some sort of music lesson soon, and we'll write more about that. Every night in her prayers... And there was a letter from Karin in big block print. Dear Mommy, Daddy, Hans, Maximilian, and my new baby brother, I miss you more than I can tell you. Wintertime is a time for ice skating on the frozen banks of the Limfjorden, and for building snow castles, and for sledding, and for sitting before a blazing fire, and having Og rub your icy feet. But winter passed, and the Limfjorden flowed again, and the countryside burst into wild bloom. And summertime came, and they all went away to the beach at Blokhus, on the North Sea. And she and Meta and Og took a sailboat 100 miles out. Life was full and rich with the Hansens. She had a flock of best girlfriends, and she loved to shop with Meta at the smelly fish market or stand beside her in the kitchen learning to bake. And Meta was so good in so many things, like sewing or with studies, and she was a wonderful comfort at Karen's bedside if there was a sudden fever or sore throat. Og always had a smile.